A Biblical Politics, Two Possible Answers, Part 2 and Q&A, was presented by Gutenberg Tutors on August 14, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
We took longer than we wanted to take, so we're going to facilitate making this short. I'm going to identify two things that I think are a possible point of difference between us. I'll invite Tim to add to that list or highlight that or whatever. And then we're just going to open it up, and we can focus maybe first on the questions that revolve around what we had to say. But let's quickly merge into questions for any of the staff, and we'll pass a mic around to let them answer your question. And that'll be the rest of the day. I see two things that are possibly different in the perspective that Tim and I are taking. The first one is civic Christianity or civic religion or something like that as a proposal. And then what did you call the... Did you have a name for this?
I didn't have a name for it. We can pick one, right?
Yes, Servant
Kingdom.
Servant Kingdom
model. Okay. It seems to me that there's an option not on that list, and that is what I would propose is not civic Christianity, because one of the things on my list, I don't think I got there, I just read the truth, but it's not the role of government to promote godliness and to promote righteousness, and you could add to that to promote Christianity. There's no way that a government is going to be able to effectively do that. I wouldn't expect the state in the name of Christianity to be able to, in an undistorted way, present a Christian worldview to the nation. But I think you could have a sustaining civic philosophy, if you will, or worldview that doesn't even pretend to be Christian, but it is in fact informed, much like I think the Constitution was in a lot of ways. It's informed by Christianity, and there are certain basic core truths that are a part of that worldview that are critical to a free society. And you'd want to fight to maintain those elements in that worldview. But you would never make any pretense that it's Christianity. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the Christians in the society can continue to look at the culture and play that prophetic mission and prophetic role that Hauerwas would not be possible. In my perspective, why wouldn't it be possible? There's all these people that aren't Christians, and they need to be called to Christianity, and they need to be called to faith, and they need to be subjected to the scrutiny, the light of the Bible in their lives. And I don't know why that wouldn't happen.
There's a scenario, and tell me if this is a scenario that would match up with what you think could be this alternative. In Georgia public high schools, you've got, of course, all sorts of discipline problems. And so about 10 years ago, the state tried to write a handbook about how to teach basically ethics and morality in public schools. And they came up with 25 character virtues or something like this. Honesty, integrity, et cetera, et cetera. These are necessary. You've got to have these just to have basic order in a classroom. Problem was, my interpretation of what went wrong is they just fell flat because there was nothing teleological about them. The students would say, okay, be honest, but where does the buck really stop? If it's not attached to some sense that I have to be honest before God, then why? Why really do it? That would seem to me to be a criticism of what you're saying. There could be some sort of philosophy that's kind of a middle ground. It's not necessarily Christian, but maybe it does uphold some of the merit of Christianity. Is that...
Well, I think it would have to be theistic.
Okay.
Yeah, there are philosophies that wouldn't be adequate to the task, and then there would be worldviews and philosophies that would be. It's like I liked what that Jewish philosopher said in response to Hauerwas. So that's exactly my perspective,
yeah.
Is that what he saw in Christianity was it was theistic enough, moral enough, objective enough, believed in truth enough. It had all the elements that could provide a space in this society for a Jew who's not a Christian. But it provided the space for him because it had all the philosophical and intellectual resources to provide a basis for morality and character and so on and so forth. Does that make everybody a believer if we present that philosophy? Far from it. No, of course not. But it does provide the basis and the foundation for living together in a free exchange of ideas, liberal society. And I haven't given up on the idea that that's possible.
I know in Massachusetts there was a big debate over homosexual marriage in Massachusetts, and there was a public statement made by a handful of different religious leaders, Orthodox Jew, Muslim, Protestant, Catholic, and they all stepped forward in their full regalia and said, look, as theists, we can't get behind this in some level. And I think that there is sort of a trend among people who are politically active, Christians who are politically active, to recognize our co-belligerents are the theists. They're not, we just don't have much in common anymore with like a secular humanist, whereas 200 years ago there probably would have been a lot in common there. But I think Hauerwas is going to argue that's fine, but that's ad hoc, and ultimately if these community of the church is not healthy in some way, and again, what healthy means, we could have a long debate about that, but if it's not doing its job, then soon you ain't going to even have, you're just not going to have anything left soon.
Well, sure, and I certainly agree that the church needs to do everything it can to persuade people of Christianity so that that's personal and individual and vital and engaging in the culture, because that will keep the other stuff plausible. And if the church loses, then that philosophical, that civil philosophy is going to crumble as well. So there's more to maintaining it than just telling people, you got to believe this, you've got to maintain it. But to be a supporter of promoting that kind of theistic worldview and make that the basis and foundation for a civil society, I don't see any problem with that. I think you can do both.
Yeah.
You have to have in your own communities, try to promote real Christianity in your own community, and for the rest of the world, for the rest of our country, I can't enforce Christianity on them. I can't make them Christians. But can I at least persuade them of a worldview that would allow us to live together? We're way past that, so getting back there right now, I don't know. I don't even know if it's possible.
But what you're saying, I think, there's great merit with regards to how do I vote? Mm-hmm. When I go out tomorrow and I've actually got to punch the ballot, I can either pick the guy who most adheres to this kind of shared sense of whatever it is, civic Christianity, let's call it. Or, and this is kind of the pattern that I've fallen into lately, is you largely have to ad lib it. You put McCain on one side and Obama on the other side, and you've got a list of issues that are important. And you're like, okay, well, I don't really buy, if I don't buy that the civic virtue model is really going to work or the civic Christianity model is going to work, then they're up for grabs. McCain is better on this issue, Obama on this issue, Obama on this issue, McCain on this issue. So what you're advocating is just as a pattern for voting seems to me to hold a lot of merit. I didn't do it last time, but I'm sympathetic with it.
The only other issue that I potentially saw as a difference between us was on the issue of maybe the church, and I can't remember the wording you used. You talked about the two spheres, that there's the state, but above that is my allegiance to, and was it the church? Is that the word you used?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
But to God's way, to God's people.
I may not have followed completely your argument about individualism, but it seems to me that I agree with that priority, obviously, but the way that that priority gets carried out, it seems to me, is best carried out by individuals. And I guess the thought that came to mind is, even within the Christian community, there's a difference between free market spirituality and socialistic spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the church from the get-go has been socialistic spirituality. Mm. The worst thing that ever happened to Christianity was the invention of the church, as far as I'm concerned.
Huh. That would be a point of disagreement.
So I thought I would just highlight that.
I don't think that you really believe that. So, although I'll admit that I took your 25-page paper and I put it into a Word document and I searched, did a word search on church. And it wasn't there.
It wasn't there.
Not at all. And so I do worry a little bit that the church has fallen out of your ontology, because I don't think it's fallen out of the New Testament ontology.
Well, the church as an institution, I don't believe it's there.
I think the church is
the gathering of those people who as individuals are committed wholeheartedly from the core of their being to the service of God, to the love of God and the knowledge of God. And the minute we start dictating to one another how we need to do that, which is what the church is designed to do, I think we're already on the wrong road.
I think part of the reason that I'm a Protestant Christian is because they understand, the Protestants get really close to this, I think, in saying, the church is not a visible institution. You can't go put your hands on it somewhere. unlike the Catholic Church, would say, no, you can point to it. It's this right here. You can look at it and put your hands on it. And so the church in the Protestant view is invisible. You could be sitting next to someone in the pew, and that person doesn't know God at all. I don't think I'm as fearful of the institutionality of Protestantism, maybe, as you are. But I think probably in practice, we're probably in fairly close agreement. I was telling my friend Kate, who's somewhere here, I said the biggest argument against my point of view is that the Gutenberg tutors and larger community who adhere to this very individualistic notion of Christianity have treated me with greater respect and dignity and love than any other group of strangers that I've ever met. It's a great vote in favor of what you're advocating. However, you're a community. You've been sharing a life together for a long time, and you've been knocking off each other's hard edges, and you've been having a conversation with each other that's been going on for a long time. So my understanding of the church is something like this. It's this sustained community that's always in conversation with each other. It ain't ever going to work if the person's not rightly oriented vertically toward God. It's just never going to work. But there's this great benefit that I see, and I just don't ever want it to be neglected, that we're in this together, and we actually do help each other.
Yeah, no problem with that. Obviously, as I said, the bond and the unity that is created by those journeys being toward the same destination is huge and is very important. And if it's not there, there's something wrong. So I'm not against community. I'm just against people telling me how to be in community.
Right. You want to open it up?
Yeah, I think so.
Jack, this is a question for you about what you just said about not wanting anyone to tell you how to be a community. What are your thoughts on, say, church communities that recognize the value of this great tradition, 2,000 years of people trying to work out the kinks of what it means to be a Christian in community. So there's this accumulated wisdom that's built up, and a lot of that is contained in the church structure. And I'm not saying that the church should subsume all of our individual responsibility to have this relationship with God that is entirely individual. But that there's I feel like there should be some recognition of this, the democracy of the past, this community that's preceded us and has spent so many years toiling over these questions. What do you think about that?
I may be wrong, but the reason that doesn't carry any weight with me is because my perspective on church history is that the picture you painted is a myth. We would like to believe that that's what church history is, but I think the reality is there was a whole lot of coercion going on, a whole lot of violence, a whole lot of force, a whole lot of excommunication and stripping people of resources in order to control them and make them be the kind of Christian that somebody in power wanted them to be. They dictated their doctrines, they dictated their practices, they dictated every aspect of their faith. And I really think we need to step back away from our past and look at what it is. I think, in fact, the real work of God is not what went down in history. The real work of God was in the life of ordinary individuals who, in spite of all that stuff going on in the organized institutional church, were nonetheless, in the midst of that, coming to terms with the reality of God and learning to know him and love him and save him. But they're the quiet, unwritten people that were doing that by and large. With obviously, there are some real people that went down in the pages of history that I'm impressed with. But for the most part, it's the real work of God. The church was being sustained in spite of history, not through what we think of as history. It was the powerful people that made history. It was the godly people that suffered and endured under that. I'm just making all that up and exaggerating terribly, but it was just a counter myth to your myth.
I think that's certainly like a big part of what went on. And in fact, I would say what I would argue that those individuals who performed these sorts of unchristian acts, tried to coerce people into believing and were violent towards one another, I would say those people, when they were doing that, were actually not a part of the church. And so there's this sort of political dimension to the church as it functions in history. And that's sort of what you're talking about. But in terms of the church community, I think that it has been absolutely filled with individuals in community working towards a more perfect way of loving one another and loving God. And that is at least an equal truth to the truth of this historical and political aspect of the church's role.
But you were talking about looking back to them, right? Wasn't that the premise of your question? Can we look back and
Yes. Is there any value in the accumulated wisdom of the church?
See, I'm in the position where how am I going to know that this is wisdom? I need to go back to what Jesus and the apostles taught to judge whether the individual acts of these people through church history were really a continuation and a faithful embodiment of the teaching of the gospel and the teaching of Jesus, or whether it was some weird aberration that was a result of their cultural situation and their own individual egos and whatever. So if I'm going to go back somewhere, I'm just going to stick with Jesus and the apostles and figure out what that is. And if I bump into somebody in church history who's the embodiment of that, and I go, wow, that's cool. What a neat example of that. That's fine. But I'm going to look to Jesus and the apostles for my wisdom. I'm not sure there is an accumulated wisdom throughout church history, because every generation forgets what they got, and the next generation has to start over and learn it all over again. I just don't think there's a whole lot of accumulation going on.
What about somebody like Augustine? It seems like Augustine would kind of match up with Kate saying, here's this guy, the Roman Empire falls, people don't know what to do, and Augustine himself looks back at Jesus and the apostles and says, okay, look, here's the game plan. But he is taking the gospel and he's putting it into his particular time, and we still look at like the city of God as this wonderful articulation of the difference between the city of God and the city of man, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man. And it seems like there is great benefit in that.
You don't want me to answer? No, yeah, there is. But look at all the damage Augustine also did. When you get to the Reformation, you have the Roman Catholic Church using Augustine to support their side. You have Luther using Augustine to support their side because he said both. He was a mixed bag. He was confused. He was, at the end of his life, I think he was really very much the New Testament had saturated him, and he was thinking and talking in terms of the terms of the New Testament. Early part of his life, he was so enamored by Plato and Platonism that he spoke as much like a Platonist as he did a New Testament Christian. So yet, even in Augustine, you have to look at all of what he's saying. Where is that coming from? Do I really believe that? Is that really true? Does that match the worldview of Jesus and the apostles? So I have to look at him critically. But in the process, yeah, you find some aspects of what Augustine said where you really see this intelligent, wise, godly man having imbibed the teaching of the gospel and expressing it in a new and a novel way that's very, very helpful. Yeah, no problem.
So one of the things that has jumped out to me this week is how the different economic systems that we're become enamored with is really a reflection of how we see humanity. And it seems like what has gone wrong with the church in America is we've adopted Marxist and Keynesian approaches to governing churches instead of, I'm throwing this out here for you to both of you to comment on, versus a free market approach to churches. Is that fair?
I think so. I didn't flash on that until Tim was speaking, but Marxist that he is, you know. I mean, but yeah, that is exactly what came to mind, is that these issues that we're talking about are of vital importance to the way Christians organize themselves as well. We can do it in a way that's completely contrary to everything we believe about what a human being is, or we could do it in a way that is completely compatible with what we know a human being is. Maybe you need to say something before we're done, but the classic example of that is the way that Christian groups find a way to ostracize members. If you don't knuckle under and conform enough, either doctrinally, lifestyle, practice, or whatever, then we're not going to allow you the freedom of conscience to just hang with us and figure out whether you agree with us or don't agree with us. You need to quickly enough fall into line and conform, or we don't want you around. We don't want your kind. And of all the people in the world that shouldn't be taking that position, isn't it us?
And aren't there more benign examples of even how are we going to do church and impact the community? We're going to do home groups. We're going to do all this. And we set it up as if we can control the impact that a church has within a community. And I go back to some friends that were part of a church, and they were in the home group for like 7 years, went through a series of crises, and these people that were supposedly part of their community completely abandoned them. And it just struck them like, wait, we were following to a T the structure to impact our community, but the whole thing fell apart when it was actually tested. And it was just that mentality that we don't trust our own membership to pursue their own sanctification and respect that and show regard for them is pervasive.
Having been a part of a couple of churches that I just think are wonderful, that get it and practice it in this way that I think the New Testament is advocating, if I had a choice between being part of one of those churches and just being on my own, I 10 out of 10 times choose to be part of one of those churches. If I have a choice between being on my own or being part of one of the churches that probably all of us have been a part of, just sort of, it's more just social conformity more than anything else, then I'd be on my own 10 out of 10 times. And so again, part of what I am trying to emphasize is that we all know the church is messed up. I'm about to quote Augustine to make my case, which may not fly too well here, but she's a whore, but she's our mother. That's kind of my take on it. The way I understand it is the New Testament is saying that I need to be part of a community of believers, knowing all the extreme dangers that come with that. And yeah, I'm not obligated to stay when it gets completely corrupted, but I still think it's an effort that should be made. It should be.
It seems like as much as there's the issue with building on Andrew's point with the like the Marxist or the Keynesian model, and on the flip side of that, there's also the capitalist business model of church that's equally as problematic. And it just seems like it is the problem of humanity that we want to systematize that thing that we do so we can know where we stand and have some kind of security. And so, I don't know, it seems we're going to talk in like political, socioeconomic sort of systems, neither side, unless you're doing like a truly free market, individuals coming together like the ecclesia, then it's a problem. Does that make sense?
I have a question, I think, for Jack. It was something Tim said, which I thought was kind of interesting, and it was the church has dropped out of your ontology. And I'm not sure what Tim meant by that, but it got me thinking for a moment, and I suppose this is my question of, is it okay to just talk about the church obliquely or like indirectly just in terms of the individual? I'll draw an analogy to either atomists or something else, where an atomist believes that all there is just matter in motion and it's all reducible to atoms. So anything that's more complicated in terms of like animals, let's say, or trees or something, do trees really exist? No, trees don't exist. All that really exists is atoms. Or another example is like cells. You can imagine cells and they have their intelligibility, but if you just look at cells, you never quite get to zoology. We have to kind of change the order at which we're talking about. But once we do understand zoology, then we can look back at cells and kind of we glean a greater intelligibility, a greater context. And I'm just wondering, although I totally agree with you that individuals are the source of, just as healthy cells make a healthy animal, you know, so also individual Christians living authentically is the source of health within the community or within the church. But is there some loss of intelligibility? Is there some, like, is it reductionistic to talk about the church only in terms of the individuals within it? Or is there some greater intelligibility that might help us understand the individuals more? Or, I don't know. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's just half.
I don't think it's true that the church has dropped out of my ontology. So to make clear what I mean by that, if something is God's idea, the creator's idea, it has a concept that corresponds to it that is God's idea, then I would put the church as God's idea. It's there. And the church is, in a sense, different than and greater than its parts, in the sense that what makes the concept of the church is that you have these individuals in unity with each other and who have that shared life and shared hope and so on. So in that sense, I think the church is still very much there in my ontology. And I probably overspeak sometimes, but the point that I'm trying to make and the point that I'm trying to emphasize is from really very early on, the church was turned into an institution. And I don't have a place any longer for the institutional church in my ontology. I don't think God, from before the foundation of the earth, ever intended for the church to be a human institution that would endure for his sake and on his behalf. That's really more what's dropped out of my ontology than actually the church. I think the church should be an organism of sorts. To follow Jonathan's example, thus an animal is more than just the cells. It actually gets organized and becomes its own being in the form of a dog or a cat or a cow or something. I think the church is an organism, but I don't think it was ever intended to be a construct. So, I need to think about this some more, but I've lived it. I haven't analyzed it. It's when you start having hierarchical structures where human beings take positions of power, and out of that position of power, they take themselves way too seriously. And when they take themselves way too seriously, they begin to act coercively and impose their ideas and their values on other people. They don't trust them with their sanctification. They don't give them the space to... When I start dictating to you, for the sake of your relationship with God, here's what you will do and here's what you must do, rather than just being a brother on the journey with you, available to persuade, to encourage, to counsel, to teach, to ask questions, that I know you have to figure out and you have to decide, and you have to decide whether you're on board or you're not on. You can work in community that way, and it can be a very vital and real community, but you don't have to turn it into a game. I guess that's what I've been impressed with, is we've spent several thousand years playing church, and it's just time to stop playing and start doing business with God, seems to me. But we play act at this thing that we've invented, this thing called church. That's what I mean by the institution.
It's kind of weird. We're talking a lot about church, so I'll just ask real quick. It seems to me that all the churches I've attended and having been part of the community movement and et cetera, and watched it morph through the 60s into now, when he talks about church in the Bible, he uses the term field, body, building, bride, people, priests. And as I look back, I realize that the people running the show sort of lock onto their favorite metaphor and then build the church around that metaphor. It's completely artificial, but they get a warm fuzzy when they read that particular word, or there's some sort of emotional explanation for them in that word, and so they ignore all the others, and that's what it is. And I've been in bride churches, and I've been in building churches, and body churches, and it's like they don't agree on things simply because it doesn't fit their metaphor. I think, hello, they're just metaphors. You guys can't get together because you can't turn the page and read the next one. But so you guys can comment on that if you agree or don't agree. But my real question is, it suddenly struck me that the Constitution and its protections and its rights that they claim they recognize, not that they create. The authors say, well, we didn't make this up. This is like given to us by God. This is by virtue of being a man, you have these freedoms and rights. You think there was ever anything in the back of their head, given their knowledge of European history, that one of the reasons they cataloged these into law is to protect the individual believer from the former mega power of the church in their cultures and countries? Because, I mean, if you think about it, there was a time when the church could take your life. And these guys said, no, the state can't take your life. No one can take your life. That has to be done through process. And liberty, the pursuit of happiness. The church used to take people's land. And they're saying, no, you can't do that. You have a right to that. And it just suddenly occurred to me in this thing that, wow, what if they were kind of sneaking in the back door, looking out for the little guy against the history that they knew about?
Today, in the discussion on Ayn Rand, I flashed on how all the different interests in the church is one of them in history. That business can be this way, the military, to the extent that you can conceive it of as independent of the state. What they want is the support of the state in order to give them an invincible power. If you have the state, you can use violence to advance your interests. Otherwise, you have to persuade, market, you have to use more gentle forms of persuasion. But if you got the state on your side, now you can use violence. Who doesn't want that if they want to establish their position?
Just to be crystal clear, when I use the word church, I know that I'm using this loaded term, 2,000 years of history. And I'm in no way saying, yeah, remember the good old days, 1200 AD. That was great. I'm not saying anything like that. So I'm being real selective about what I mean by the church. So to piggyback on Hauerwas again, Hauerwas and his ilk and myself included, look at this time that we're kind of hitting. They call it the post-Constantinian time of the church. If you know your European history, you know Constantine, Roman emperor, comes in. He says, great, I need kind of like a public religion. The old pagan gods aren't doing it for me anymore. Christianity, awesome. And so that kind of held sway in some way or another, whether either officially or unofficially, for 1,500 years. And Hauerwas and myself are saying at the end of that, ooh, that is a good thing for the church. Inasmuch as the church is aligned with the state and their ends become the same thing, the church is totally messed up. So I'm not advocating the capital C church of the last 2,000 years. My view of the church and what Jack described, they're very much in keeping with each other.
None of the major political theories is compatible with all 14 of these truths. None, that is, with the possible exception of something roughly like American constitutionalism. I think that the critique against socialism is exactly right. I have some curiosity what you would say with regard to the fact that American, or that some have argued that a particular political structure needs to be in keeping with the character of the people that the political structure is associated with. So, for instance, given the radical individualistic character of Americans from the time of the American Constitution and continuing on through our period of time, it seems like the American constitutionalism is a very valid form of government that is appropriate for that particular character of people and the kind of moral structure that they had associated with them. It is not completely clear to me that that particular format of government would be the best form of government for all characters of people. I could imagine a situation where the character of the people, were they given the opportunity to vote and have control in some sense of what the laws are, there is a sense in which constitutionalism allows for democracy and for people to vote for the various things, that they would be far more abusive of that kind of power than, say, a different, I don't know, aristocratic, more educated, possibly, that you could, it seems to me that it's possible to have a culture where American constitutionalism would not be the very best situation. So I was wondering if you had any comment with regard to that particular topic.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. That's why Tim's paper provides a great corrective. It takes more than the raw skeleton of American constitutionalism. You really have to have a worldview in place that supports the kind of individual character that is going to be able to work within that system without becoming opportunistic, like David was talking about. So education is huge, you know, people being trained up to that, into that worldview. So I was assuming all that, but that you can't assume that. That's a good point.
In my own experience of being in and also sometimes encouraged out of a number of churches, I've had the opportunity to see a lot of Christians who were attempting to operate on the fringe of the institutional church, often for even long periods of time. And one thing that struck me, and that I guess strikes me in life as well, and this is kind of the basis of my question, is that it seems like even when individuals get an incredible amount of freedom and take responsibility for living out their Christian faith, they tend to gravitate towards what they like, what's like them, essentially what's kind of selfishly going to make them happy. If they're challenged, it's the way that they like to be challenged and not the ways that they don't like to be challenged, that they gravitate to groups or places that are like that. And I guess I hear groups shortcut defending individual freedom by saying, well, yes, humans will gravitate towards selfish things that may not really be what the church is about, but God's sovereignty will guide them back to something if, as long as they're faithful. And then people who are in the institutional church will say, yeah, the institutional church isn't great, and there might be coercive things about it. We kind of need some of those coercions to keep us from going too far off the path, but God's sovereignty will take care of us. And I don't know, it just seems to me, I mean, there's a big parallel between all of our economic discussions, because that's kind of what they're about, a semi-socialist church or a free market church. But I look at Gutenberg even, and I see, well, the Tudors are people who like to study and to read books and to discuss, and so the majority of the time here is spent doing that. And so if there was someone to come and stay for a long period of time who was not about that and was about other aspects of the Christian life, that might be hard for them, and they might have to leave to go to a different group. And so, long-winded question, I'm sorry about that, but I guess my question is, how would both of you on the different perspectives say that the propensity of human selfishness and just to gravitate towards what's comfortable for us could be combated so that something greater than just selfishness is accomplished by church or community?
Unless the Bible is not speaking the truth, that if it is the truth that we are focused on, the gospel, the hope, the wisdom and knowledge that's in Jesus, if that's really the focus, and then I as an individual, if you get a number of individuals who center their life on that, the bond that that creates between people should be stronger than any potential alienation because of culture, race, personality, different style, and so on. If that's not true, then I think the Bible's lying to us. Then I don't think the gospel's true if that's not true. So I think the problem, I mean, the reason that the churches can't seem to become cross-cultural and transcend those barriers is because they're just not flat-out centered squarely enough on the truth of the gospel. Like Tim was saying, I think the church, by and large, in sad shape, and I think it's precisely because it's all about all kinds of other things other than the truth of the gospel. We almost self-consciously create cultures in our churches now. Well, of course you're not going to be creating a welcoming environment for somebody who thinks your culture stinks. It's only going to be attractive to people who are comfortable in that particular culture. It seems to me that an ideal church would have people who have very, very different cultural styles and comfort zones, but what draws them together is this message of the gospel is so powerfully central to my life that I share that in common with all these weird, kooky people that have different value, cultural values than I do.
Jack, I think you and I are seeing the same thing from slightly different angles. I just had a thought while you were reading your paper when you got to the part where you say, "It is not chauvinism, I think, but sober reflection that leads me to conclude that America was purposed by God to be a unique experiment in human history." I don't necessarily disagree with that in the sense that I think America, it certainly is unique. It has been, in the sense of personal liberty and freedom to worship God as you believe, it has been certainly unique, but I think perhaps it would be more in line with the ideal of humility to call it not a unique experiment, but yet another example of the failure of man, even man with good intentions, even man who love God, to govern themselves apart from him. Just a thought.
Point well taken. Yeah.
This goes to all the tutors. It's an open question. I was just wondering, I guess it's hard when I'm asking, what is your experience? Because you all have different experiences, but I'm wondering what, in your experience, is the best use for systematic or scientific or objective, as in, like Ayn Rand talks about objectivism, thought, like, where's the best place for that? It could be the model of economy or our personal lives or different forms.
So go through that list again, the best place for
The what? Best place for, like, systematic, scientific, objective thought as far as personal life, or it could be the economy. Maybe an example would be Keynes coming in and after the wartime saying, hey, it's time to think about things a little bit more. Free market versus applying the science, freedom versus kind of more control. And I think my personal life, I think, yeah, there's that balance between being open to anything happening and not controlling and walking into the darkness, and then there's the time where it's good to think, you know, and to figure things out and finding that balance. And I say usually it's after the experience when there's a war, something goes wrong. It's like, oh, man, like what happened? So I kind of step back. And I don't know, my experience has been more rewarding to not control and systematically fix everything and then in order to do it right, but just to live and be okay to mess up in faith that I'll learn. But I don't know. I was just curious with your guys' experience when those two bounce or whatever, yeah.
Well, I think it's obviously always going to be a mix of two, of both of those things. Both of those are beneficial, and both of those are just part of the human experience. I think the way I would think about it is this. What we tend to do largely, I think, is we build a theory, and it's not conscious that we sort of do this for the most part. But we have an understanding of how the world works. And we just kind of go through life, things hit us, bounce off us, and we go through life and just kind of roll with those kinds of things and accumulate sort of randomly experiences and understanding. But there comes times where, for instance, something hits us weird, or we come to a point where we just don't understand something. And at that point, I think there's two things we can do that are helpful. One is go back and kind of look at that jumble of experiences and things, and then just sort of organize them. Just sort of begin to organize those ideas. That will help us then sort of work our way through whether what's bugging us sort of fits with what we believe or not. Is this getting at your question? I'm not sure that it is. Oh, okay. Well, in what sense? Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, okay. Okay, I wasn't tracking, sorry. As I commented on a question once, I'm primarily an ecologist by training. And as I look at the natural world, it's chaotic, it's decentralized, and it looks purely absolutely chaotic at one level. But yet it looks very organized in the end to me. I tend to wonder why the economy ought not to work the same way, our human economy. So I'm inclined to not want it very organized, that I think that there is a way it ought to function, and at times it's out of whack. And so I'm attracted to Hayek's sort of perspective, who's basically saying, look, if it's within bounds, decentralized and chaotic, that works fine. But there are those times where, for one reason or another, it's gotten pushed out of the bounds from where it can work in sort of its natural fashion. And at those times, there are actions you can take that can promote it to come back where it works. And one of his characteristics of those actions is that it's neutral to who's going to get favored. So, but he is saying that there are those actions you can take, and when you get to those places where it isn't working right anymore, take those actions, but the whole goal is just get it back in the range where it's going to work decentralized and sort of randomly, and you still have an ordered, coordinated process. Is that answering your question? So I'm attracted to Hayek's view because in the end, as I say, it's for me, I've been looking first sort of towards one economic system and the other, and depending which, I usually have the aquatic ecologist hat on. But it seems to me that that's exactly what's structuring my view of how to restore and reconstruct the aquatic systems that I work on. It's the same thing. All I'm trying to do is determine why isn't it that they're working the way they ought to work, and it's usually because we push them in a weird way. So my goal is kind of just, can we back off whatever it is we pushed and just let the natural processes essentially just start working again and put it back in the condition it was in before we pushed it. And so it's really the same sort of view. You're trying to minimize your impact, and when you do something, you just want to go in with the goal of just letting the system work for itself. I like the analogy here sort of with medicine, is there's sort of two views when you're in a certain amount of trouble. And one is that sort of minimalist view that I'm going to do the minimum you can and just let the body cure itself. Or you can take a much harder approach, hook up all the machines. I'm really going to push here hard and I'm going to restore to perfect health, sort of engineer it. There's those two sort of views we can even take towards medicine. And what I'm saying is I sort of prefer the former. Second one kind of scares me. I don't know. Does that help or make sense? I don't know if there's anybody else who wants to add or subtract.
So I'm less afraid of total chaos than I am of systematic chaos. And because we live in a relatively systematic chaos environment, both nationally, I would say more on a global economic scale too, I wonder how much one economy can take when it's being handled so much. Seems like there'd be a certain stress level when it just, you can't do anything more and it totally escapes. You can't control it anymore. It just kind of becomes like this wild feral thing that it's, I think, is supposed to be, and it rejects that control. And I wonder if there's a predictable point at which that happens, or if it's just something that we should just expect to happen overnight, any night, but not be paranoid people.
I guess I'm not clear on systematic chaos.
Government controlled, trying to control the chaos, so they're trying to systematize the chaos.
And you're less afraid of?
I'm less afraid of total chaos. Like, I'm less afraid of a free market system, which there's no real predictability, than trying to control that chaos.
I don't think this is answering your question, but while they're thinking, the people with the answers are thinking. But remember, in the free market, the socialist doesn't like free market economics because they look at it as chaotic. What proponents of free market say, and this comes right back to the ecology example that Charlie gave, it may look like chaos if you look at it in a particular way, but actually it's not chaotic at the highest level of order.
A couple of things come to mind, sort of going back a little bit to John's question. I think that we can make some progress in trying to understand how the forces of the economy work in the same way that we can make progress in trying to understand how the forces of ecology works. For instance, some of the problems that you run into, however, when you're trying to understand how the economy works is that there's a lot of things, a lot at stake. There's a lot of money at stake, a lot of power, a lot of various things at stake. And I think Charlie would agree with me that when there's a lot at stake, that's when things start getting messed up with the ecology. It's the same thing that can happen in the American economy and various other economies. When there's a lot at stake, there's political pressure and things can get out of control. But it doesn't seem like there's any reason why we can't try and understand exactly how the economy works. And to the extent that those people who do understand and have been successful in understanding how the economy works are given the ability to make adjustments or something like that in order to help the economy along, I don't think that there's necessarily anything intrinsically wrong with that. Except that there is, of course, this problem that who are those people that are making those decisions to affect the economy and what are the consequences of those? And sometimes the consequences are unintended. And then the last thing I will say just briefly is that I think it's possible that the economy is even more complicated than ecology. And the reason why is because men are very creative, and the economy is based on how men interact with each other. So as soon as you feel like you've got a handle on how this economy is working, somebody changes the rules. They make something new. They come up with a new technique for how to do finance, or a new technique for how to do this, or something like that. And as soon as something new comes along, then all of a sudden you've got to be adept enough to recognize, oh, something new has come along, and how does that affect our understanding of how the economy works? So it seems like you finally figure out, even if you could figure out exactly some of the features that were going on, you have to be aware that new stuff is popping out all over the place. And I know that I'm not exactly sure if that's the way Charlie looks at the ecology, but it seems like that might be a little bit different. I don't know. Those would be my comments.
So basically, economics is like Calvin and Hobbes.
I don't know if there's time to get to this, but I'd be interested, David, Chris, Charlie, Ron, the two of you, if there is anything, given where we're at right now in the economy, with our society, with the church, if Hayek is to be believed, in the last 12 months racing pell-mell down the road to serfdom, if Hayek is to be believed, is there anything that each of you, if you, in your mind, when you go to bed at night or when you're talking with your kids or your wife, is there anything that you would say, I wish that we, and now we happen to be speaking to Christians, I wish that we would be thinking or doing this? Is there something that comes to the front of your mind as something that we are missing in terms of what we should be thinking or doing in light of where we're at right now?
If I'm at all right in my perspective, I wonder if we as Christians shouldn't take over political education in our country. I don't think it's being done anywhere significantly. The heritage, the tradition of the Constitution is not really being passed on, and it'd be interesting if Christians would just decide it's worth it. Let's try it, see if it works.
My concern is I don't think there's a quick fix, that anything that would be effective at this point is going to be a long term. I would agree with Jack. I think education is the key there. What is the founding fathers understood that the democratic system would only work if the people that were involved understood the dynamics of the system that had been set up and therefore knew what to be on the lookout for. It seems to me that laissez-faire economics is the same thing. It has the same issue, and that people need to understand how the thing works and what where it can go wrong and what are the kinds of problems that are involved and what are the implications and what kinds of values are necessary need to be in place in order for it to work, et cetera, et cetera. And I think education is the key, but it's not the kind of education that could be put in a pamphlet and done in 2 or 3 days. That it's we're talking about a rather significant amount of ideas that need to be presented and thrashed around and worked on before people are in a place to understand that kind of thing. But that's what has to happen, I think, because it's a change in perspective that's going to have to happen. And that's both in economics and in politics in order to save this.
I had two words for you originally when you asked what would we desire that we had been thinking about all these years that had been on our mind, and that was individual responsibility. But to answer what you just said, David, education is hugely, hugely important. People need to know how to think and how to look at the big picture. It's something that's sorely lacking in people all through society at every level. People that can only see the good of the moment. But ultimately, I think if even people who know how to think, if they disagree about what is important, their ability to think is only going to help them further their cause. I'm not advocating at all that we not educate because there are those who disagree with us. That's ridiculous. But I think even more important than education is changing people's hearts, because ultimately, this is where Marx got it wrong. If you believe that happiness comes from material possessions and that the greatest evil is to be deprived of material possessions, you're going to strive to further the accumulation, the ability of everyone to accumulate material possessions. This is how intelligent people get it wrong from our perspective. They have different values, different ultimate values. So I couldn't underscore enough, like you're saying, the importance of education, but even more than that is the root of what they believe. We have to work to offer them the truth for their consideration and for the work of the Spirit of God, because ultimately if they disagree with us, fundamentally, there's nothing we can do to save the system we're in, because they're ultimately going to see that system as evil. They're going to see capitalism as depriving those of the ultimate good, because what they see as the ultimate good is material things. So, end of soapbox.
I'm not going to defend this right here and right now, and anyone's welcome to shoot me down later, but I think it was in Plato's dialogue, Phaedo. The question is, can virtue be taught? And he never gets around to answering the question, which kind of, but he kind of leans towards I think he says no a few times, but I'm not sure if he means it. But it seems like from that, he says that virtue can be learned or understood, but it can't necessarily be taught. And I guess that's just something to push out there.
I just want to know if any of you guys know of any books on economics written by Christians, whether you agree with them or not.
Okay, so we discussed this in our small group, but I don't think we ever really came around to an answer. But it seems like prior to World War II, wars had, they were punctuated. There was a beginning and an end. After that, and in current time, wars may have a distinct beginning, but there is no distinct end. How does that influence economies? And it's interesting, I could speculate, well, one of the benefits for the government is it allows them to have more control over, but I guess I'm just more curious. David talked a lot about how so many things in a national economy feed back into the military, and here we are with prolonged wars, ambiguous wars. Is it a war? Is it a battle? Very ambiguous.
We have now declared a war on ignorance.
When you do look at history, you look at sort of what are called generations of warfare, and I think it is the case that after World War II, we entered a new generation of warfare. It's not unprecedented to have long periods of time where it's questionable or not questionable whether you have a war. I think of the 100-year war. It's hard to say when it began, when it ended, if it's one war, two wars. Since you can look at World War I and World War II and say, well, really, weren't they the same war? We just stopped it for a few years, but fundamentally, it's primarily the same thing. So I would say in throughout history, the idea that it's been tough to decide when it begins and when it ends, that's sort of not the issue. But the structure of war for a long time has sort of been it's at the state level, and so a state's finally ultimately going to surrender or stop, or you're going to have some kind of agreement you're going to stop. So when you're playing by those kind of rules, then it's kind of neat. You know, it's tidy. But it is interesting when we hit these times where it isn't tidy. In a sense, it is a different kind of war, and there is a sense in which you have to structure your economy around that. So, I mean, I'll give you an example on the other side of this. Take Germany in World War II. Hitler basically designed and ran his economy given a very short war, and in fact, he didn't even change most of the economy into wartime economy. His strategy was, we're going to go in, hit, move fast, and have it over before it impacts the economy in a big way. Well, if you are dealing with a war now that's going to be very protracted, unknown, you do have to take that into account into your economy. Now, two things will happen. One is a government will always use that to its benefit if they want to do military stuff. But you'll even see what we see now. The military is arguing for a particular airplane. Actually, if you look at it, would be absolutely useless in the type of war you're actually fighting right now. Well, is it going to get built or not built? That's really a political decision about what district's getting how much money. But this idea of a protracted war is, yes, you have to think about the situation here. Yes, you have to allocate resources to that. Yes, it is going to be a drag on your economy, in the sense of you're putting your resources into defending this kind of a war. So it is a new day. It is a different style of warfare, not unprecedented. But yes, it is one that economically is not going to be run in the same way wars were before. Before, like World War II, and from Napoleon to World War II, the big wars were usually wars of attrition, meaning who's got the most men, who's got the most planes, bombs, and you're just going to keep annihilating people and stuff until somebody's running out. So that's how, like, fourth-generation war worked. That's really industrial war. This is a new day, because if you ever put an army in the field, one weapon could take care of your army. So, as I say, it creates changes both politically, economically, as well as militarily. You have to think about the impact of this situation, and you are going to have to change things like changing what you buy, recognizing you're going to have to now spend out for a long period of time at some kind of a sustained level. Does that make sense?
I hope you don't mind. I'm sort of interested in returning to that question about ontology. And I thought Jonathan's point was really interesting in that there's a way in which our being is composed both of parts and a unity of the parts, right? And that both aspects of our being are essential to one another. Without the parts, the unity is meaningless. Without the unity, the parts are meaningless. And so I was thinking, like, institutions have become almost like a bad word in contemporary society, I think in a lot of circles. So I was trying to think of an institution that sort of captures that balance of the parts and the unity. And this may seem like a strange model to a lot of you, but I was thinking about AA as an Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is an organization, an institution that functions incredibly well. And it draws people rich, poor, intelligent, not so intelligent. The whole spectrum of humanity comes to this institution because they have a common sickness, a common ailment. In some ways I would equate to like human fallenness, right? So I'm making an analogy between AA and the church. But it's not just, and this organization requires that individuals make personal commitments to becoming sober, right? So it's not just the institution imposing sobriety from on high, like you will be sober and therefore you will be sober. So that's an important part. So this individual commitment is essential to the way the AA functions. But this other part of it, and I believe that every single recovering alcoholic who participates in AA will tell you this, if they do not attend those meetings, if they do not humble themselves in these rituals of obedience to the community. If they don't have that community of people, they will not be sober. In other words, their sobriety, their salvation, is not purely an individual matter. They require that community in order to achieve that aim. And so I would just be interested in hearing what you have to say about that, and sort of AA as a model for Christian community, which sounds strange.
Well, to follow your example, but notice that all those people that find the community of AA helpful are keeping the commitment. There are many people who go to AA who'd never really make the commitment, for whom the fact that it's a, what do you call it, community doesn't do them any good. So I'm not arguing that we're not helpful to each other. Look at, we're called upon to encourage one another, to strengthen one another. I can't remember all the language, but there's plenty of language in the New Testament that testifies to the fact that I can love you in a particular way. Is when you're confused, I'll let you borrow my eyes so you can see with the clarity that I'm seeing right now. And tomorrow, maybe I'll need to borrow your eyes so that I can see with the clarity that you're seeing at that point in time. And we help each other in very significant ways in our relationship with one another as believers inside the church. So I have no quarrel with that at all. I wouldn't deny that. And I think that's exactly analogous to AA. But nobody, no community can bring about my sanctification if I don't want to. Just can't happen.
I've noticed in places where people are poor economically that there tends to be a more natural gravitation towards cooperation, not necessarily automatically, but just as a general trend, it happens more often because of necessity. And that in countries that I've been in that are more wealthy, that there tends to be more of a deferment to government or a tolerance of poverty with some and wealth with others in near geographic locations. And I'm curious what any of you guys would say about wealth's relationship to the church, and however we define church, but wealth's relationship to Christians, either contributing to the hyper-individualism that Tim was referring to, or whether that's a relevant connection or not.
My general sense is there's a lot of talk about it. If you look beyond the talk and the kind of longing for individualism, you really don't have the kind of independence of thought or independence of action that everybody thinks that they are portraying. So we were talking about this, I think, in yesterday's discussion with Hayek, that teenagers in particular are all absorbed with being an individual and being so different, and yet the upshot of it all is that they're all being radically different, and they all look the same. They all look the same. There's not really any kind of substantial radical difference between them. So I just don't think it's really out there. I think people either they give up on thinking for themselves because it's so difficult, or they've just been told that they can't do it. Not that they can't do it, but that there's nothing to really discover. And without that kind of tough commitment to really think for yourself, then I don't see how you can really have strong individualism at any other level, unless you just have some quirky, antisocial individuals. But there really aren't a lot of those.
One of the kind of critiques of the recent 100 years in American culture is that what you see happening is government at the top, and I'd add maybe like the media broadly at the top, and you've got a bunch of individuals at the bottom, and what you had maybe 300 years ago, 200 years ago, are lots of mediating institutions between this and this, mediating institutions being something like the family, the neighborhood, the church, civic organizations, et cetera, et cetera. These have disappeared. Mediating institutions have disappeared. And so a critique from somebody like Robert Putnam, Peter, that wrote Bowling Alone, or regardless, I think it's Robert Putnam, is that without these mediating institutions, you get exactly what you just described. You get people just sort of buying into whatever it is the media is selling, so you get this massive groupthink. So I think actually it's this groupthink that you're describing is happening because there's nothing in between the individual and these big, huge like media, government, et cetera, et cetera.
I think there's lots of narcissism. I think Facebook is kind of pseudo-community, wittering. You know what I mean? It just seems to be a pathological narcissism. And maybe that's what you were thinking of when you're thinking of individualism. But I don't know. It seems to be too different.
It seemed to me to be a good idea to come up here and say something a minute ago. because I thought it had something to say. Now I've realized that I am so tired that my brain is not functioning. So I realize you're all looking at me like, why are you looking at me? Are you going to say something? But so I apologize for this. Was a minute ago, this was very coherent and relevant to what it is that we're doing. The complexity of this question, I mean, I've been listening to the whole thing about the church and all of that stuff. The problem is, it seems to me, in support of the kind of thing that Jack is saying, at the heart of the New Testament teaching about community, it starts with my choice to identify myself with Christ, to say Christ is, in fact, the Messiah. He is my King, my Savior, all of that. He is my teacher. And so that means that his people are my people. And I see it in practically every book of the New Testament, this theme over and over again. To me as an individual, to make the choice to follow Christ and so make his people my people. And all of the New Testament authors see, you know, we talk about the testing of our faith having to live itself out in the world. And one of the key ways that we encounter the testing of our faith is whether I'm going to live out my faith in the world by acknowledging, yes, all of you weirdos are my people. You understand what I'm saying? That, as Jack was saying, it cuts across all sorts of things. You have that experience. If you've been a Christian for a while and you've taken this seriously, you have that experience where you come across somebody that you realize, by nature, I would not get along with them so well. They're not a person I would choose to hang around with a lot. And yet we have that thing in common. And so there's something that sort of draws us to get past the things that separate us, because not that we're ever going to be great friends, perhaps, but we're in this thing together. So this organic unity that arises out of in the body of Christ arises out of this sort of mutual attraction that is generated from a truly sanctified heart. If I encounter the unity of the church in the world, and it's the real thing, it is arising from that. That gives a certain organization. In Jonathan's terms, we can look beyond the cells into the thing itself. But I'm also a person in a social community, in a political community, and there's all sorts of different ways that I'm cells of things. And what gets complicated is that the church is also, I really like what Jack is saying, but I think it, as we try to sort it out, it takes a little more, we have to try to sort of specify, well, what do we mean? But the fact is that Christians get together. I mean, you can't help it. I mean, if you're going to encourage each other in the gospel, you're going to want people who have had the opportunity to study more in the Bible to explain things so that you can understand more clearly what's going on, and that makes sense that it would happen that way. And so you start to have organizations. If it's a small little group, or you've joined so that you have, you're a Presbyterian and you've got all of the that structure and everything, I mean, something like that is going to happen because something has to happen. I mean, people get together and somebody's got to figure out when is the potluck going to be, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So, and then, but the thing that gets complicated for us is it's very easy for us to start to want to substitute the social dynamic realities that we face in those kind of groups with the spiritual reality that we have been called to. So, Eric, the kind of thing that you were talking about, it's true. I think our wealth has an impact on us, and we need to pay attention to that reality. But at the same time, we recognize if there was this big flood that came through Eugene right now, it would pull this community together in a marvelous way. I mean, we'd all band together and be helping each other, and we'd be, just be struck by the generosity of strangers and all of that kind of stuff, all of whom are not, or many of whom are not, sanctified members of the Church of Christ. They just, an unusual experience has forced them to band together to help each other. I just think it's important that we not, if there's a bad thing about the institution of the church, it is that it has tried in various ways to substitute, to say, what can we do to foster this, to make this thing happen? And we find various techniques, and ultimately that ends up being coercive, because if you're not with the program helping us do this thing that's going to make it better, then you're in the way and all of that. I'm a big believer in, this is my last statement for this whole thing, is I don't know if I can explain this. I've tried to write about this sometimes, and I don't know that I've communicated it very well. But my whole life I've heard people talking about what's wrong with the church, what do we need to do to get it on track, how can we make it so that it's effective and being salt and light in the world and all that kind of stuff. And maybe I'm just totally out to lunch, but as I read the New Testament, I don't think that's the way to talk about it. That is, we all talk as if somehow it's failing and we have to figure out some way to fix it. I don't think it's failing. I think the people of God, God is working in them through trials, difficulties, teaching, experience, the grace of God, so that we are maturing slowly and coming to the place where the people of God mean more to us than they did before and so forth. So I think the church is doing its thing. The church is working. People of God are coming together as the people of God, as messy as that is. And I just think it's important not to confuse that, which is a reality that cannot be stopped and is happening in the world, with the techniques that we might think of so that we can foster a more overt communitarian look or something like that. I think those are two different things. And now I'm done.
Yeah.